to Russia's borders during five waves of expansion starting 1997, when it formalized its relations with NATO. The diplomat said it absolutely cannot suit Russia when it is required to send troops to barracks on its territory, while at the same time the Americans, the Canadians and the British are building bases in Ukraine and the Black Sea region.
Russia's efforts to strengthen ties with its neighbors demonstrate differences between the CSTO and NATO. Russia and its allies leave countries at the end of military missions, thus establishing strategic partnerships. And regarding unfriendly policies adopted by Western governments towards Russia, Moscow advocates for constructive dialogue and mutual respect. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue.
Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence.
Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively. Since last few years, Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS. And so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdollahian visited China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then-Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, no detailed information has been revealed from the agreement, but the two sides say it covers economic, political and security areas.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China also reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing Vienna talks, aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018, after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urge Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
در موضوع مذاکرات.
Today we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense, and the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. The two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Fuzhou.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer, do star jumps, or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mold, damp and excessive cold anyway with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse. So
it's absolutely horrendous, because I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this:
globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price gap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saipur is up, London.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Democrats are staring down an ugly reality in the U.S. Senate. The historical malapportionment of the upper chamber, which awards two members to every state, even though Wyoming's population is not only 68 times smaller than California's population, but smaller than 115 counties nationwide, already places the party at a disadvantage. We now present you an article written by David Daly. The piece is titled, "The U.S. Senate is Undemocratic. That's bleak for Democrats' midterm hopes." Democrats have it tough now, trying to keep a precarious U.S. Senate majority in tune on a $1 trillion-plus budget reconciliation package without a single vote to spare. Well, just wait. These days of 50 Democratic senators may soon look like significant days. Democrats are staring down an ugly reality in the U.S. Senate. The historical malapportionment of the upper chamber, which awards two members to every state, even though Wyoming's population is not only 68 times smaller than California's population, but smaller than 115 counties nationwide, already places the party at a disadvantage. This edge has only become more prominent due to polarization and population patterns, and will collide next with a challenging map in 2022 and an even harder one in 2024. It's a problem so intractable that it makes even partisan gerrymandering seem like child's play. Demographic change won't help either. Democrats are simply packed into fewer states. According to a 2020 Data for Progress study that hands Republicans a 3 percentage point advantage. According to 2020 census data, the nation has grown more multiracial and less white, a trend which should, on balance, favor Democrats. But while the emerging Democratic majority is happening on paper, it has been structurally blocked from achieving political power. The white, non-college-educated voters that make up the largest part of the Republican coalition are shrinking in numbers nationwide, but they're better distributed. Those rural and less educated voters still hold a dominant position in enough small states to claim a decisive grip over the U.S. Senate. Maybe 130,000 New York hipsters can be persuaded to move from Jackson Heights, Queens, to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. It might be the best investment any liberal billionaire could make, since this is a political problem for Democrats, but also a crisis for democracy, without any easy solutions. The political analyst and pollster, David Shaw, suggests that even if Democrats deliver a good performance in 2022, defeat Republicans by 4 percentage points, and surmount the losses that a governing party historically faces in the midterm elections, they have about a 50-50 chance of holding the majority. David Shaw says, win a more slender majority, say 51%, and they'll likely lose a seat and the Senate. This isn't a new development, of course. The structure of the U.S. Senate has been inegalitarian since our founding, and the nation's political geography has provided the Republican Party with a baked-in edge for decades. But contemporary partisan trends have exacerbated it. The Republican Party held the U.S. Senate between 1994 and 2006, and again, from 2014 through to 2020. However, According to research by Stephen Wolf of Daily Kos, Republican senators actually represented a majority of Americans during just one electoral cycle over those decades, and that was in 1996-1997. Right now, the 50 Democratic senators represent 41 million more Americans than the 50 Republican senators. Stephen Wolf added up every vote cast for Democratic and Republican Senate candidates over this period and calculated the total over every six-year period in order to determine which party had more support over the period of any given Senate term. Only during a small window over those three decades, covering Senate elections from 1994 through to 1998, did Republicans ever capture that three-cycle aggregate vote representing every ballot cast for all 100 senators. The trend line for Democrats does not look to be improving. The 2020 census showed that more than half of the 330 million Americans live in just nine states. That means upwards of 50% of Americans have 18 U.S. senators, while the smaller half has the other 82. According to a University of Virginia forecast, by 2040, half of the nation could live in only eight states, with just 16 senators. Let's break that down even further. According to census data, two-thirds of all Americans, some 219 million of them to be exact, live in the largest 15 states. They are represented by just 30 senators, 22 Democrats and 8 Republicans. But what about the other third? They have 70 senators. These smaller states aren't only whiter than the nation at large, they tilt decisively to the Republican Party, represented by 42 Republicans and 28 Democrats. That's more than enough to filibuster any legislation that cannot be passed through the reconciliation process, including voting rights, effectively granting veto power over even popular proposals to a tiny minority of voters from the smallest and whitest states. As the Maine Senator Angus King noted on the Senate floor recently, 41 senators representing just 24% of Americans can block legislation with the filibuster. The Democrats' future looks even bleaker when you graph that geographic reality on a deeply polarized nation with more red-leaning states than blue, and voters increasingly less likely to split their ballots between a presidential candidate of one party and a U.S. Senate hopeful from another. The Senate has become as sorted as the rest of the nation. Should the Senate represent states or the American people? Should one-third of the nation retain the power to block legislation favored by large majorities? What does it mean to hold the consent of the governed when Democratic candidates for the U.S. Senate, but also the U.S. House of Representatives and the White House, must win by large majorities to have a chance at holding more seats or electors, but Republicans can capture both chambers with fewer votes? In a moment in which we are focused on racial equity, how can we hand bonus representation to smaller, whiter states, ensuring that the Senate leans towards the interest of white voters on any issue where whites and communities of color diverge? And what does it hold for the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, when 5 of 9 conservatives have been selected by presidents that lost the popular vote, then confirmed by senators that represent a minority of Americans? There is no equality in a system so widely malapportioned. A Congress designed 240 years ago to guard against the tyranny of the majority now ensures that a white majority in a changing nation maintains veto power simply by virtue of the smaller states where they live. Perhaps that has been the point of the Senate from the beginning. More than 25 years ago in 1995, the former Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan observed that sometime in the next century, the United States is going to have to address the question of apportionment in the Senate. We've arrived at that moment, but now what? One solution would require Republicans conceding their advantage in the interest of representational fairness and broadening their appeal to voters in a multiracial nation. The other solution requires Democrats to broaden their appeal and win elections in states turning decisively the other direction, then using that power to add states or make otherwise bold reform. At this moment, as Republicans cement an enduring minority rule through gerrymandering, geography, and the courts of law, and Democrats appear unable or unwilling to muster any meaningful response, both options feel equally unlikely.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin, January 5th, 2022.
وفادار موندن به اسلام و به انقلاب با همه وجود به اسلام و انقلاب وفادار موند به عهدی که با خدا و با امام بسته بود به این عهد وفادار موند.
He was loyal to Islam and the revolution. He remained loyal to Islam and the revolution with all his heart and soul. He remained true to his covenant with God and Imam Khomeini. He remained loyal to his duty towards the Iranian nation and the Islamic nation with complete conscientiousness in his actions and all his being. He did his duty towards the Iranian nation and his duty towards the Islamic nation. Some people try to create a dichotomy between the Iranian nation and the Islamic nation. The root of this was started by the enemies, and it is they who are doing this. Some people negligently follow the same line. Inside the country too, we sometimes see the people who are working for the Islamic nation stop looking at and paying attention to the Iranian nation and vice versa. Inside the country too, we sometimes see the people who are working for the Islamic nation stop looking at and paying attention to the Iranian nation, and vice versa. But our dear martyr, Martyr Soleimani, proved that a person can be the one in the country who cares the most about his own nation and the most about the Islamic nation. He is the one who cared the most about his own nation and the most about the Islamic nation at the same time.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
ملی‌ترین بود از کجا معلوم؟ از تشییع جنازه او.
He cared the most about his nation. How do we know this? We know this from his burial ceremony. Since the time of the revolution, which has been a time of great rallies and gatherings, What other example do we have of large gatherings of the people similar to the burial ceremony of Shahid Soleimani, in which tens of millions of people participated? Who were the people who participated in that ceremony? They were the whole nation. Well, a nation could not have been shown using delusions. The nation was an existing outside reality. Tens of millions of people came to that man's funeral ceremony after his martyrdom. So, he cared the most about his nation. He also cared the most about the Islamic nation. Over the past 2 years, his name and memory have been gathering more and more importance in the world of Islam. The name and memory of Martyr Soleimani is repeatedly being mentioned in the world of Islam, and this is increasing. People can clearly see this. He was truly a manifestation of truthfulness, of the believers are men who are true to the covenant which they have made with Allah.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
We'll be right back.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kabir Tahlaib. On Saturday, the Yemeni army issued a warning against the UAE, one of the partners in the Saudi alliance in the war on Yemen. The United Arab Emirates, UAE, should await a harsh response for its escalations against Yemen. It reminded the Persian Gulf country that Abu Dhabi's fragile glass towers are, quote, easy to reach. That reach was executed just 2 days later. Yemen's army launched drone attacks deep inside the UAE. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether the UAE and Saudi Arabia, for that matter, will change course in this war or continue with their failed offensives.
The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have hit the heart of the United Arab Emirates, with officials in Abu Dhabi confirming two fire incidents near storage facilities of an oil firm and the city's international airport. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army says Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel, which had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime in Yemen. In April 2018, the Emirates deployed its military to Socotra, an island that overlooks the strategic Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. 2 weeks later, Saudi troops were also deployed there, a move the Yemenis described as a coup against legitimacy. The UAE had largely scaled down its military presence in Yemen in 2019, but continued funding, arming, and training mercenaries in support of separatists in southern Yemen. It became quite clear when forces loyal to former Yemeni government, aided by UAE-backed brigades and Saudi warplanes, reclaimed the oil and gas-rich southern province of Shabwa earlier this month and made advances toward Ma'rib province. However, the Yemeni army's repeated retaliatory drone and missile attacks inside Saudi Arabia and now in the UAE show the coalition is losing the momentum. It has also inflicted heavy losses on Saudi and Emirati-backed militias operating inside the country. Since last year, the Yemeni army, along with Ansarullah forces, have liberated nearly 20,000 square kilometers of land in several large-scale operations. Nearly 7 years of bombing campaigns and blockade on Yemen have proved fruitless for Saudi Arabia and some of its regional and international allies, including the U.S., as they fail to achieve their intended goals. On the other hand, Yemen's armed forces and the popular comedies have grown stronger against the invaders and give them crushing response to their deadly mayhem in the impoverished nation.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have activist and political analyst Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joining us from Sana'a. Also joining us, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both, and Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, let me first start with you. You had a warning that was issued by the Yemeni army And then two days later, Abu Dhabi was hit. Drone attacks deep inside the UAE, 3 fuel tankers in this incident. And it took place in your storage facilities of the ADNOC, which is the oil firm of the UAE. Tell us how significant this is, and tell us why the Yemeni army decided to choose this time for it to execute this attack.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. They have chosen this time because the United Arab Emirates have declared a long time ago that they have withdrawn from Yemen and they are not involved in the war. But actually, in the recent week, United Arab Emirates has extended its attack and its strike on Yemen. They have resumed their attack. 100 of airstrike targeted Yemeni civilians in Shabwa region. And United Arab Emirates' role in Yemen is no different than Saudi Arabia. But on the top of that, they actually supporting separatists. They're trying to divide Yemen, controlling Yemeni island and some of the coast of Yemen, building air base there. So United Arab Emirates' goal is to divide Yemen, and then they will try to be, or they are actually a tool of the United States and the Zionist state of Israel. What's new about this latest attack on the United Arab Emirates? That comes after 3 or 4 days after Yemeni official here in Sana'a have warned United Arab Emirates if they are not going to stop their attack, that they will be under a target. And as Yahya Sari, the spokesperson of Yemeni army, he have declared United Arab Emirates as unsafe state, and he has as well called foreign company to leave the country, because at one point Yemeni army will target Abu Dhabi airport directly and will target many industrial area in United Arab Emirates. We have seen that United Arab Emirates has admitted that attack because I believe they could not hide it, as they did when Yemeni forces 3 years ago have targeted Abu Dhabi airport. United Arab Emirates have denied at that time, but then Sana'a has released CCTV footage from the airport that shows that attack. And this is the first time Yemeni army used a ballistic missile to target, as they say, Abu Dhabi airport and Dubai airport, including as well refinery and other sensitive and important area in United Arab Emirates. That's why I believe that United Arab Emirates is still hiding some of the damage that has been done today by Yemeni attack.
Sure, that has actually been reflected in some media outlets. But Elijah Magnier, our guests are talking about how one of the reasons, anyways, for the attack is that the UAE announced a couple years ago, that it was withdrawing from the war in Yemen. That its strategy in that war has changed, and it announces the end of its direct military engagement there. Why do you think that the UAE would do that and yet continue with this war while it's still evident that it's participating, and at the same time it was at least covered in a way where it said it was a fatal blow to its relationship to Saudi Arabia?
This is a very good question. Actually, the Emirates have said that in the past, and not only after the attack on the Emirates, we saw the Stockholm Agreement coming out in 2018, establishing a ceasefire and redeployment of forces because they were critical to ease humanitarian crisis. The second point of the Stockholm Agreement was the opening humanitarian corridor to facilitate the freedom of movement of civilian and goods. And the last point is the prisoner swap. So nothing has changed. We haven't seen very little of prisoner swap, and we've seen very little of ceasefire, redeployment of forces, and humanitarian corridor. The siege is still established against Yemen, and the Emirates did not respect the Stockholm Agreement, and it's pushed by the Saudis to continue the war because the Saudi insist, notwithstanding all the losses they on the Saudi economy and on losing on the ground with all its mercenaries. So because the Emirates jump in again, then the Houthis warn the Emiratis that there is a price for what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And the Houthis warning was very serious. We've seen it today. But what is very surprising is how the world jumped on one attack against the Emirates when on the same day there were 38 attacks from the Saudis and coalition against Yemen. So there is really nothing that is balanced on the mainstream media, and the war in Yemen is looked at from only one angle against the Yemeni,
sure,
and in favor of the Saudis. At the end of the day, the Saudis and Yemeni are occupying Yemen. They should leave.
Well, that's a very good point that you make. The fact that you have 38 attacks take place. Hussein Bukhaiti, our guest, talking about that. That's not covered, where you have this one attack and you have a blitz of media coverage on this. Do you think that that is because of the fact that UAE is small? It's a haven for what you have, the presence of foreign investors, real estate sectors, and basically port exports, and all different foreigners and expats in that small island. You have the world somewhat engaged in one way or another with that island. And that is why you have the coverage that you have, which at this point, this particular attack may actually threaten overall its economy.
Yes, I mean, if you see that United Arab Emirates, its economy and its industry, its focus on Dubai and Abu Dhabi. That's why I believe if Yemeni army will continue its attack, United Arab Emirates will be affected more than Saudi Arabia, because we know the size of Saudi Arabia is big, and as well, United Arab Emirates depend 95% of its economy on the export of oil, and the other 5% is on tourists, and there are millions of foreigners who live in United Arab Emirates, tens of thousands of foreign company. That's why we have seen as well, if you check the so-called flight radar app, you're going to see there are less flight on United Arab Emirates. Just 1 hour ago, there were two flights, one from Doha and one from Istanbul, has actually directed its flight away from Abu Dhabi airport. And this means that the damage that has been done to the airport, and maybe the companies and flight companies will think again to use that airport and as well Dubai airport. That's why I believe more attack against United Arab Emirates, against its airport, against its economy, it will bring it to its knee faster than Saudi Arabia, and then Yemeni army will be actually able to liberate more areas in Yemen. And just one final thing, I have seen in many media, outside media especially, they call that today attack as an escalation. They have forgot that Yemen is under attack for more than 7 years. Hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians has been killed. The blockade, the constant attack on Yemeni industry, on Yemeni infrastructure. That's why we have come to a point, an eye for an eye. But even though Yemeni army is still careful in taking and deciding when to attack, and there was as well about 10 minutes ago two airstrikes on Sana'a. That's why I believe the coming days we will see more attack against United Arab Emirates if they are not going to stop their war against Yemen.
Well, okay, I guess we do need to talk about this alleged magnitude. I mean, our guest makes a very good point. You have a country that's being bombed rather continuously in the past 3 weeks. It has escalated this bombing campaign by Saudi Arabia and the Saudi-led coalition. And not to mention the past years that the country is experiencing not only the bombing campaign, civilian deaths, but the humanitarian aspect. But scant coverage, not only on that aspect of it, but the way that it gets twisted, as if this one attack that took place today is heightening or escalating the war. So the media is trying to twist this story towards the other side, isn't it?
Yes, of course. I mean, let's start from the Biden administration, when President Biden came to power and said he wanted to stop the war in Yemen. And then he backed off on that, and he's no longer concerned about stopping the devastating war on Yemen and the huge, biggest ever humanitarian crisis that hit the country. Now, we see how the media is dealing with Yemen at the unforgotten war, and suddenly everybody remembers it when there is one or two or a dozen of attacks against Saudi Arabia or the Emirates, and they don't see the hundreds of attacks that are hitting Yemen for the last 7 years. That's really the way mainstream media is dealing with it, because they don't want to upset Saudi Arabia, because there is a lot of money involved from the Saudi in different countries, and because we see the United States, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, they all supplying Saudi Arabia with weapons to be used only against Yemen, because this is the only place that the Saudis are using their weapons, and they are very much aware of it, but they don't speak about it because they don't want to be involved in this humanitarian crisis, hiding behind their finger, not knowing that they are indeed responsible for every single crime against humanity that is committed in Yemen.
Well, we need to break this open in terms of the UAE role played in this war in Yemen, Hossein al-Bukhaiti. We know that it is part of the Saudi-led coalition at this point, involved in the bombing in one form or another. But there is another role that the UAE is playing that Saudi Arabia does not like. Break that open for us if you can. And that is how the UAE supports the Southern Transitional Council and its fighters, as opposed to the way that you have Saudi Arabia support what they call Yemen's President Rabah Mansour Hadi, which is not the case. Yemenis actually don't accept him or hold him legitimate. What is going on there? Why has there been a divergence there when it comes to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, particular about the Southern Transitional Council?
The United Arab Emirates is a direct toll of United Kingdom, and we know that United Kingdom it was occupying south of Yemen. That's why they have now more interest in the country. And as they say in England, or when they concur in Yemen or other country, they say divide and conquer. And this is exactly what the United Arab Emirates is doing. I mean, United Arab Emirates' role in Yemen is more dirtier than Saudi Arabia, because, if you were going to look at it, at least Saudi, it says that support the so-called Hadi legitimacy, which is, they call him as the president of Yemen. But on the other hand, we see that the United Arab Emirates is supporting those separatives. They are building airport. They are misusing and damaging Yemeni port. They are actually stealing fish from Yemen. They are stealing everything, especially as an example in Socotra. This means that they are actually want this war. They want to stay in Yemen. They want to divide Yemen. And as well, they are fighting the so-called legitimacy or Hadi. The many time in Aden and other area, they have fought. They have used Al-Qaeda. They have used ISIS. So the role, if it's not like Saudi Arabia, actually is more, they are more involved in Yemen. And we've seen the amount of weapons that was handed by United Arab Emirates to the so-called the separatists in south of Yemen. That's why I believe if Yemeni army will extend its attack, especially against United Arab Emirates, I'm sure that United Arab is so weak, and it will bring it to its knee, and it will stop the war against Yemen. And we have seen those many condemnation today against this attack show you that over 200,000 airstrike on Yemen, there isn't any single condemnation, especially from the United Nations or any other country. Even though, we remember when they targeted the funeral hall in Sana'a, killing more than 1,000 Yemeni civilians and injuring more than 1,000 Yemeni civilians, United Nations has called it an incident. That's why Yemeni army should step its attack despite what kind of condemnation coming from country who actually selling weapons to United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia.
Sure. But I need to have Elijah Magner, you tell us about what is perhaps or most arguably one of the most underreported aspects of this war, and that is the goal that the UAE has had on Socotra Island, taking that over and then bringing on, after the formal announcement of the so-called normalization of ties with Israel, bringing Israel on board, making that island in what was reported to be a spying center. But aside from that, how that's going to connect that part, which is very strategic, to other ports, for example, in Africa, with Israel on the UAE's back. Tell us the relationship there that exists between the UAE, Israel, and the purpose Socotra Island and the ports serve for whatever intentions they have.
This is absolutely a very good question. Indeed, the role of the Emirates has been very noticed in the last years since the normalization with Israel and the intensive relationship that came to the surface. However, this relationship is not new. So what the Emiratis are doing in Yemen is really to protect the navigation and the interests of the Israelis in the island of Socotra and also on Bab el-Mandeb, because they are supporting 100% the Zionist regime, and they are acting on behalf of the interests of Israel in the Middle East and elsewhere. So if you look at the Emiratis per se, they have no interest in being in Yemen or expanding their forces and their presence to create an area of influence, because this is not a big country. It's a very small country based on a bit of business and wealthy people there. Mm-hmm. They have oil, and that's their role. And now they've taken upon the role of being the the shield for the Israelis, and the avant-garde of the Israeli interest in the Middle East, to really race any other country in the area of supporting Israel, hence their presence in Yemen for that purpose. And we see the visit they are coming, they are holding with the Iranians, thinking that they can compensate of their relationship with Israel. Well, the Iranians said it clearly, if you want to stop the war in Yemen, you have to go and talk to the Yemeni, accept a ceasefire and lift the siege and get out of the country, because this is not your country and you're occupying it. And it seems now with the Yemeni attack, perhaps the Emiratis got the message, and maybe it will serve them for another couple of years and stay away, as they've done after the Stockholm Agreement when they were bombed by the Houthis.
Okay, last question, Hossein Aboukhaiti. Did the UAE get the message, as our guests there said? Less than a minute.
With you, I don't think they will get the message, because today attack Yemeni forces have tried, I think, to avoid, as an example, to target the industrial site in Abu Dhabi directly, or as well to target the oil field. There are a huge oil field like the so-called Zakam, and as well Bouhassa and others. If Yemeni army, if United Arab Emirates will continue its war, I believe that those major oil sites will be under attack. And after that, United Arab Emirates and their reputation around the war as a hub for international companies will be destroyed. But we still, if they're going to do that and they're going to stop, there will be no more attack. But I don't think they will do that, only if Yemeni will hit hard inside United Arab Emirates.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We're fresh out of time. Hossein Aboukhaiti from Sana'a there, activist and political analyst. Many thanks. And Elijah Magnier, thank you for your contribution from Brussels, journalist and political analyst. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikoa Tahwe and entire team, goodbye until next time.